Chapter 11. Invisible Coasts. Cleopatra's nose, had it been shorter, the whole face of the world would have been changed. Blaise Pascal, Pensée. When Darwin was hobnobbing with pigeon men, it was the power of selection he wanted to hear about, not the power of crossing. I sat one evening in a gin palace in the borough, amongst a set of pigeon fanciers, he writes gleefully to a friend, when it was hinted that Mr. Bolt had crossed his pouters with larger runts to gain size. And if you had seen the solemn, the mysterious, and awful shakes of the head which all the fanciers gave at this scandalous proceeding, you would have recognized how little crossing has had to do with improving breeds. It has often been loosely said that all our races of dogs have been produced by the crossing of a few aboriginal species, he writes in The Origin. But by crossing, we can only get forms in some degree intermediate between their parents. Did the Italian greyhound, bloodhound, bulldog, etc. exist in the wild state? No, of course not. Ergo, he writes, the possibility of making distinct races by crossing has been greatly exaggerated. Darwin was so eager to build a case for natural selection that he may have missed something here. Hybrids may have been more important to most breeders than he thought. At the turn of the last century, the American geneticist Raymond Pearl, adopting a so-show-me attitude, cultivated and quizzed hundreds of breeders just as Darwin had done. Pearl asked bantam breeders, for instance, if they could document a case in which a new bantam line was created solely by selection of small-sized individuals of a large race, variety, or breed of fowls without any crossing in of bantam blood. Pearl got his answer from the world's leading authority on bantams, one J.F. Entwistle. If such can be done, Entwistle wrote, then our 30-odd years of experience of bantam manufacturing counts for very little. We have lived to see the manufacture of some 40 varieties and none without crossing so far. Darwinian selection plays an extremely minor and unimportant part in the process as it is actually performed, Pearl concluded, swinging the other way from Darwin. Today, unlike Pearl, the Grants know that Darwinian selection does work. They have seen it work. Now, as they contemplate the rise of the hybrid finches, they are beginning to suspect that selection and crossing work together as part of the same creative process. There are two kinds of shorelines in the islands, the visible and the invisible. The visible shores are the black broken rocks and white broken waves where volcanoes rise out of the Pacific. They are the borders of the air, the sea, and the lava, wave-gnawed rings around the summits that have given Darwin's finches their homes in the middle of nowhere. These shores are defined simply by the level of the sea. The invisible shores are the borders between the birds themselves. These shores are more intricate. They are defined by the secret codes and unwritten rules that wrap each of the 13 Galapagos finches in a kind of self-invented isolation. These boundaries hold each species apart from the rest, with the interesting exception of the hybrids, so that even though 7 or 8 of them may share the same volcanic summit, feed together in mixed flocks, scrape the same cinders for the same seeds, they still breed as much apart as if they were themselves an archipelago of enchanted islands. Darwin helped to map the visible coasts of rock and coral sand. The Beagle was a surveying ship. But his thoughts about the invisible borders between species were inconsistent and confused. In his first secret notebooks, he described species as isolated by their sexual instincts and equipment. Later, he became so absorbed in his principle of divergence that he neglected this aspect of his subject. What holds the new species apart? What are the barriers and what makes the barriers harder or easier to cross? These are coasts that Darwin left more or less unsurveyed and unexplored. Evolutionists understand now that the isolation of species is not merely a matter of populations locked apart by mountains, canyons, or seas, as Darwin's finches are held loosely apart by the visible shores of the Galapagos. The isolation of species consists chiefly in the invisible barriers that can carve off a corner of a population into a new island, or carve a single large population into a set of scattered, more or less lonely gene pools. It is not just intersterility that produces these invisible shorelines, as between horses and donkeys, nor is it physical or physiological incompatibility, as between elephants and their fleas. Darwin's finches can interbreed and produce fertile young, but something keeps most of them from doing it. The barriers around the birds are invisible because they are created by the creature's own behavior. It is not anatomy, but instinct that holds them apart. To inquire into the origin of species is to inquire into the formation of these instinctive, invisible barriers. Though Darwin himself had trouble with the subject, the secret of the origin of species lies somewhere along these viewless coasts, these shifting shorelines among living things. Clearly, once varieties begin to split off from one another, they need some way to keep themselves apart. Whether they diverge in isolation or partway in isolation and partway in each other's company, at some point they do have to learn to breed with their own kind, their own new kind. Otherwise, a new line would blend with the lines around it and disappear. Darwin was impressed, for instance, by the work it took to maintain fancy lines of pigeons. If breeders crossed their birds carelessly, their creations would soon revert to their starting point, the common rock pigeon. All the pigeon fancier's whimsical creations, all those pouters, fantails, laughers, and scandaroons, would be lost. What holds these breeds apart and prevents their collapse to the origin is the pigeon fancier's continual vigilance in arranging crosses. The best of the breeders in Darwin's day, like the famous pigeon man Sir John Sebright, could tell by eye a difference in beak of 1/16 of an inch. Darwin writes, pointedly, that he had to work hard to persuade these exquisitely sensitive pigeon fanciers to make the kinds of crosses that would undo their lines. Such experiments went against the grain, he says, even in the name of science, even for a fee. Darwin had to cajole and wheedle, reminding the breeders that, after all, even ugly birds are still good for the pot. It is Darwin's argument that natural selection can arrange matches too, and better than the best human breeders. The selection process will give living things this gift, this talent, simply by choosing the fittest variants in the nest, the litter, and the seedbed. It will improve their ability to tell one another apart as naturally and inevitably as it improves their ability to eat or to fly. Selection will act this way because those individuals that make bad choices in their mates will suffer a disadvantage. Their offspring will be less likely to prosper in the struggle for existence. Those individuals that make good choices will enjoy a corresponding advantage. Their offspring will prosper. That is why hybrid finches should be rare on Daphne Major. In a population that is diversifying, evolving distinctive adaptations, selection will tend to preserve a new and valuable invention, because individuals in a gradually diverging line will have an adaptive advantage if they choose, as mates, others in the new line. If they choose a mate within the line, they stand to perpetuate the new adaptation. If they do not, they stand to lose the adaptation. They lose the family jewels. So there is selection pressure on creatures like Darwin's finches to learn to discriminate. Those birds that evolve a sexual taste for the new line will do better than those that retain a taste for the old line. In this way, natural selection will ensure that the bird's own powers of discrimination are finer than the pigeon fancier's. It will make birds in the wild, as Darwin put it, their own Sir John Sebright. The power of natural selection will make birds of different lines sexually repugnant at mating time. Darwin saw some evidence of this kind of mutual repugnance even in the pigeon coops. In natural selection, he reports that the dovecot pigeon, the ancestor of all the breeds, seems to have an actual aversion to the several fancy breeds. But when Darwin describes the finches of the Galapagos, probably the earliest colonists, having undergone far more change than the other species, it is the visible, physical isolation of their islands that he stresses, not the finches' invisible, instinctive isolation, which Darwin knew nothing about. Among Darwin's finches, a mating season begins with all the black cocks on the island singing in the rain. Each male broadcasts from his singing post, and while he sings, he scans his territory. If a female alights near one of the display nests that he has built, he darts from his singing post and flies to her. If she is one of his own kind, he sings and shakes his wings at her, makes them quiver tremulously. Then he flies to the nearest nest. Any nest will do, even the nest of a rival, if the rival is out. He goes in and out of the nest, looking back at the female over his shoulder. Sometimes he picks up a bit of grass in his beak and puts it down again, rapidly, over and over, as if he were trying to catch her eye. If the female hops toward him, or at least if she does not hop away, the male begins what the Grant team calls the sex chase, flying after her on a twisting and undulating flight path. He swoops and pivots in midair in what looks to the finch watchers like maneuvers to keep the female on his territory. The female stays just a wing beat ahead of him, making high-pitched cries, "Kew, kew, kew!" These are ground finches, remember. Their wings are short and stubby. They are not really cut out for this kind of aerial acrobatics. The long, twisting flights must require fantastic amounts of energy to keep up, especially after a long dry season of thirst and famine. In other words, the sex chase is expensive. But all the finches do it when they court, young and old alike, even birds that have mated together for years. Laureen Ratcliffe and Peter Grant watched more than 1,000 finches pair off and go chasing each other through the air. In all those courtships, they saw a male go after a female of the wrong species only 26 times. And in the middle of each of those rare cases, either the male broke off the courtship or the female flew away. In 4 of the mismatched courtships, the male stopped flirting and actually attacked the female. Long ago, before Lack, an ornithologist speculated that Darwin's finches might all be one intermingling species, a hybrid swarm. Finches just mated with finches. That speculation, Peter calls it a cry of desperation, could only have come from a scientist who had studied the finches in the museum trays and not out on the islands. Since the very first year of their watch, the Grants have known that Darwin's finches have a talent for telling one another apart. The birds' ability to recognize one another is impressive, even a bit mysterious, given the remarkable range of variation in their beaks and bodies and the drab sameness of their plumage. It is true that the 6 species of ground finches look different from the 6 species of tree finches. The tree finches' plumage is a yellowish-green, the general tint of Galapagos trees in leaf, and the ground finches' plumage is black and mottled brown, the general tint of Galapagos lava. They are markedly different birds, even though the tree finches do spend much of their time on the ground, and the ground finches spend much of their time in trees. But there is no obvious difference in plumage among the 6 species of ground finches. There is no obvious difference in their styles of courtship either. The singing post, the flirtations at the display nest, the sex chase, all seem to be the same from species to species. There is no great difference in their territories either. On Daphne Major in Goodyear's, a map of the male finch's turf is a sprawling jumble of intersecting circles and oblongs. A male finch won't let another male finch near its nest, so the epicenters of these territories, their capitals, so to speak, are always separate. And a male Scandens will not let another male Scandens claim his territory, so their turf is always separate. But the territories of Scandens will overlap with the territories of Fortis. On a map, all these territorial borders look like the ripples of raindrops in a pond. In the middle of this overlapping confusion, every Fortis has to find a Fortis. Every Scandens has to find a Scandens. The advertising song that each male broadcasts from his singing post or from his nest is distinctive enough that the Grants and the other finch watchers learn to recognize some individuals by their songs. And this is something birds can do, too. Male hooded warblers can tell their neighbors apart by their songs during the breeding season. Even after an 8-month hiatus, during which the warblers stop singing, migrate to Central America, and then return to their breeding territories, the males still remember and recognize their rivals' songs. Among Darwin's finches, there are usually not one but two or more versions of the advertising song in circulation within each species on each island. Some males sing one version, and some males sing another. On Daphne and Genovesa, a very few birds sing more than one, but the average male has a very limited repertoire. He has just one advertisement for himself, which he sings over and over all his life. The Grants have spent many hours listening to the songs in the islands and studying the song graphs at Princeton. In the graph, the song of one of Daphne's champion breeders, number 2666, is a sort of ghostly pyramid of six gray, fine-lined blotches. Finches number 2663, 2664, and 2665, the siblings of 2666, sang exactly the same song, and so did their father. In fact, most males sing the song of their father. The Grants have recorded the song of 2666 year after year, and the song graphs are all the same. They don't change.
"Peter says it sounds like Mostly Moosely," says Rosemary and laughs. "It goes, Mostly Moosely, Mostly Moosely, Mostly Moosely."
Another advertisement song on Daphne is more of a choo-choo-choo, she says. Scandens is mainly choo-choo-choo-choo-choo. Rosemary can sing them all aloud as she leafs through the song graphs.
Chi-ai-ai, this one is wiki-picky, 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 very fast.
Besides their advertising songs, all of the finches can also produce a sort of hissing whistle, a very high descending note. All of the ground finches' whistles sound much alike, although on the island of Pinta, the sharp beaks add a distinctive, drawn-out buzz-clink. So it is the advertising song that the Grants have studied most closely as a clue to how it keeps the species apart. Laureen Ratcliffe has discovered subtle variations even in songs that sound alike in the islands and look much alike in the song graphs. These variations are picked up and passed down from father to son. In a series of experiments, she and Peter Grant have taken tapes of some of these songs and broadcast them from a speaker in the center of a finch's territory. More than 9 out of 10 males reacted strongly and aggressively to the broadcasts. They seemed to respond equally to either of their own species' song types, A or B. That is, whether they themselves sing song A or song B, they will fly over the speaker, counter-sing with it, land on it, or stand in front of it and stare at it from close range. They react as if to drive away a strange male who has set up shop and begun to sing in the middle of their territory. Even on islands where two species sing much the same song, a male will respond much more vigorously when it hears one of the songs of its own species coming out of the loudspeaker than when it hears a song of the other species. Laureen and Peter tried these kinds of tests with several different pairs of species of ground finches on several islands, always with the same results. Singing the right song is important. A finch that learns the wrong song is in trouble. The finch watchers have seen, year after year, a cactus finch singing away from his tallest cactus in the prime of health. Year after year, he sings the song of Fortis. He is not getting any younger, a good bird and a good singer doomed to a genetic death. Apparently, every once in a while, instead of learning the song of his own father, a male finch learns the song of a neighbor. Once in a blue moon, he learns the song of a neighbor of the wrong species. None of the finch watchers has ever seen this kind of accident in progress, only the result, full-grown ground finches singing the wrong song. Perhaps, Peter Grant writes, they lost contact as fledglings with their fathers, were fed by a male of another species, and became misimprinted on his song. They may even have acquired the strange song in the nest, Peter believes. There are opportunities. Dolph Schluter says he once had a nest on Pinta in which a female sharpbeak and a female smallbeak each laid 3 eggs. All 6 eggs hatched, and both pairs of parents, the sharpbeaks and the smallbeaks, squabbled over ownership of the nest until the sharpbeaks won out. Unfortunately, the 6 chicks were eaten by a hawk before they ever got out of the nest. Laureen Ratcliffe once spotted a smallbeak, a male, on Española, that was keeping 2 houses a few meters apart. In one cactus, he was nesting with a female of his own species, and in the other, he was feeding the nestlings of a warbler finch. "This is a big controversy in Scandinavia right now," says Trevor Price. "A male has 2 nests,
Does she know? That's all they talk about in Scandinavia, and it looks like she does know, but that's the best she can do. Misimprinted birds are interesting because they broadcast not one identity but two, writes Peter Grant. A false one at long distance and a true one at short distance. This is one way the finches can get their lines crossed and make hybrids. The misimprinted males tend to get into fights with males that sing their song, that is, with the wrong species. And they tend to breed with the wrong species, too, when they mate at all. Even though his thinking about evolution was formed by what he had seen in the Galapagos, Darwin never quite understood how much species are like islands. The momentum of his long argument sometimes made him sweep past and ignore the distinctiveness of species and talk as if all the categories of life run smoothly together. I look at the term species as one arbitrarily given for the sake of convenience to a set of individuals closely resembling each other, Darwin writes in The Origin, as if species were just as arbitrary a convention as varieties, which are merely less distinct and more fluctuating forms. It is true that the 13 species of Galapagos finches are things of the passing moment, like the bodies of the individual birds that make up each species, like the islands that are their home, and like the very planet that is the home of all these islands. But one of the most significant facts about bodies, islands, and planets is that while they last, they are real, distinct, and separate. True species are as real as bodies, islands, or planets, though what holds them apart is not as uniform or as obvious to the eye. Even now, even with hybrids flourishing triumphantly on Daphne Major, most of the finches on the island seldom interbreed. Clearly, song is part of the finch's secret. But song is not everything. If it were, the cactus finch that sings a Fortis song would be able to mate with a Fortis female. And the broadcasts of the loudspeakers that Laureen and Peter arranged on Daphne and other islands would have had an effect on both male and female finches. The males often attacked the speakers, but the females acted completely uninterested. In almost 500 trials, only 3 females ever came over to the speakers. To find out what was missing for the females, Peter and Laureen set up 2 speakers 10 meters apart on the lava and placed a stuffed male decoy on top of each one. Now the females were more interested. They hopped over to investigate each speaker. They came closer to a male decoy of their own species than a male of another and spent more time near it. They also spent more time with a male from their island than a male from another. Obviously, the females are looking for something more than song. So are males, since when females approach a singing male, the females do not sing. Yet the male decides somehow whether the female is one of his own species, a bird of his feather, worth the trouble and expense of courting. The word species comes from the Latin verb specere, to see. Linnaeus used the word to mean groups of animals and plants that look distinctly different to the eye. After screening each other with songs, Darwin's finches must do their taxonomy as Linnaeus did. They must tell one another apart by eye. To find out what the birds are looking for, Laureen Ratcliffe and Peter Grant performed a slightly ghoulish series of experiments. They collected dead finches from the lava and also a few stuffed specimens from the museum at the Charles Darwin Research Station. They spruced up each corpse a bit and rejuvenated it with a spine of wire so that they could bend the body into various poses. They also painted the beaks of the females dark brown and the beaks of the males black, mating colors. They went to the heart of a male finch's territory right near his nest. There they propped a female Scandens decoy on one cactus pad and a female Fortis on another cactus pad. They tried perching the female decoy in various poses, sometimes in sitting position and sometimes in the much more provocative pose in which the beak is angled upward toward the sky, the wings extended a bit, and the tail spread, an invitation to copulation. In the body language of the finches, this is a powerful invitation. In fact, when Ratcliffe and Grant first bent a model into this shape, male finches began courting it and trying to mount it while the stuffed bird was still in their hands. On Pinta, where the nests were quite high, Laureen would lash the decoys to a bamboo pole and then prop the pole up at the nest. When she carried the pole from territory to territory, males would swoop onto the decoys and try to mate with them. Laureen learned to cover the decoys with a bandana until she had them ready. Each experiment began when they took away the bandanas, unveiled the two rival female decoys, and backed away. Within minutes, a male would come near and inspect the models. Usually, Ratcliffe and Grant write, the male faced the decoy, wing quivering and whistling and occasionally swaying from side to side. Then, within 5 or 10 seconds, the male mounted and copulated with the decoy. Afterward, while still mounted, he sometimes touched his beak gently to the female's head or pecked it gently. The finch watchers tested more than one species, and they repeated the tests on more than one island. Male finches most often chose the decoy of their own species. They did also show some sexual interest in females of alien species, although Grant and Ratcliffe noticed that very often in those cases, the male's displays suddenly collapsed in mid-performance. Finally, in the most interesting and grotesque refinement of these experiments, Ratcliffe and Grant tried switching the heads and bodies of Fortis and Scandens on the decoys. They found that they could produce a smooth gradation of responses. A decoy with the head of a Scandens and the body of a Scandens got the most reaction from a Scandens. A decoy with the head of a Scandens and the body of a Fortis got a smaller response. A decoy with the head and body of a Fortis got the least response. Of course, the males may have been put off by these weird-looking decoys, but if they were, there was no sign of it. Their responses to the intermediate females tended to be more or less intermediate. They were not just going through the motions, either. They left drops of semen on the decoy's tail feathers. Many other species of birds have been shown to be able to tell one another apart on sight. But most of them seem to go by bold differences in markings and plumage. A red beak, a black head, a scarlet breast, day-glow yellow eye rings. Not many birds rely on differences in size and shape as subtle as the cues that Darwin's finches are using. The Grants would like to carry out more elaborate experiments, but the regulations of the National Park Service of Ecuador and the Grants' own feeling for the birds forbid them. Based on what they have seen in the wild, the species are kept apart by two barriers, one at a distance and one close up, like a moat and a wall. The first hurdle is song. The second is the close-up visual inspection. And here the cadaverous experiments show that something about the heads of the birds is crucial. Now, there is nothing distinctive in the sizes, shapes, or feathers of the finches' heads. There is only one character above the neck that varies distinctively from species to species. The conclusion is inescapable. The feature that makes the finches most interesting to us is also the feature that makes them most interesting to each other. When they are courting head to head, making decisions that are fateful for the evolution of their lines, Darwin's finches are studying the same thing as the finch watchers. They are looking at each other's beaks. Unlike coastlines of cold lava, instincts are malleable. Natural selection can shape sexual preferences, so mating patterns can shift, change, evolve, like the beak of the finch. Experiments in artificial selection have created spectacular and sometimes rather monstrous transmutations of sexual instincts. In one lab, investigators raised fruit flies of the species Drosophila suboscura in total darkness. After 14 generations, the males no longer gave the typical courtship dance. Instead, they tapped around in the dark until they found a female and then tried to force copulation. The females did not turn them away. It takes just 14 generations to turn a Drosophila suboscura from a courtly dancer to a blind, tapping rapist, notes the student of evolution, James Shreve. How perishable are our essences! No doubt Aristotle would find all this fiddling around with the edges between things to be very dark stuff indeed. The origin of species is the origin of the invisible, isolating walls that arise between two populations and make them living islands. Individuals vary in the characters that affect their attractiveness at mating time, just as they vary in characters that affect their capabilities to feed or fly. Variations in these characters can lead to sexual isolation, as with the poor bird that sang the wrong song. Sometimes variation can grow broader, producing what have been called sex races. Gypsy moths in Japan and Korea are divided into races like these. Cross a male from one race and a female from another, and you may get females with the bodies of males, or whole cohorts of moths that look androgynous and are completely sterile. The sex races shift from one to the next, and to the next, as you travel south and west from Hokkaido to Honshu to Kyushu. Here we seem to see invisible barriers forming that can carve one species into many. The Drosophilist Ken Kaneshiro has made a special study of the courtship patterns, often bizarre, of Hawaiian Drosophila. Kaneshiro calls these flies the birds of paradise of the insect world. Like Darwin's finches, they make natural subjects for the study of evolution in action. There are more than 700 species on the islands, and more new species are being collected all the time. The Hawaiian Drosophila Project is one of the most comprehensive efforts in the history of zoological classification. Kaneshiro argues that sexual selection is a powerful force in initiating the speciation process. Often the chromosomes of two species of Hawaiian fruit flies look almost identical, yet their genitalia are strikingly different. Kaneshiro and his colleagues are now looking more closely at the genes at the molecular level to try to find the genetic changes that make the difference. Sexual selection seems to drive these divergences, Kaneshiro argues, because all the sometimes bizarre secondary sexual characters found in the males are used in some way during their complex sexual displays. The fly's extreme genetic similarity may suggest that these species are very young, that they evolved very recently. If so, the pressures of sexual selection may sometimes act much faster than the pressures of environmental change, at least to start the ball rolling, to make a branch start to split and fork. Evolutionists have argued about sexual divergence for years, as they have about competitive divergence, and this argument runs almost exactly parallel with the former. Does the divergence in sexual taste occur while the species or varieties are apart, separated by physical barriers like cliffs, valleys, and arms of the sea? Or do sexual tastes diverge when the varieties are neighbors? Are they driven apart by selection? Now, in the Galapagos, the finch watchers know that the pressures of sexual selection can sometimes compare with the intensity of natural selection. And to the extent you've got isolation, it's based on beak shape, says Dolph Schluter. So both divergences seem to be linked in these finches. Both kinds of Darwinian selection, natural and sexual, have gotten fixed, at least partly, on the birds' beaks. And both kinds of selection seem to be changing now, judging by the rise of the hybrids. We think of sexual preferences as constant and unchanging through the generations. But now we really have to ask on what grounds we assume they are constant. We know there is variability. In some cases, extreme variability from one individual to the next, both in sexual tastes and in sexual characters. We know that these features are heritable, passed on from one generation to the next. We know that they are subject to powerful selection pressures. And we know from experiment that selection pressures can produce rapid changes from generation to generation. So on what basis do we assume these things are more or less stable, like the rocks in the stream, and not merely waves and ripples in the stream? Arrangements between males and females, arrangements and behaviors we think of as primary, as given, fixed, almost as immutable as naturalists before Darwin considered species, these are not permanent at all. Behavior is the product of forces, contending forces that are still contending today, struggling within each generation. The borders between species are continually tested and redefined by the outcome of each member of each generation's luck in love, an amazing thought. Darwin never understood how the intertwining of the two kinds of selection he put on the map, natural and sexual selection, could lead to the creation of these invisible coasts. He wrote relatively little about the subject in The Origin, despite the title. Nor did he treat it at any length in Natural Selection. The 25 pages on species and speciation in his unfinished big book manuscript, the evolutionist Ernst Mayr wrote recently, contain so many contradictions that they are almost embarrassing to read. Now the picture is becoming clearer, with the help of those who survey both coasts at once, the visible and the invisible, and it is an extraordinary picture. All these forces, a wide field of conflicting forces, play like winds across the adaptive ranges that hold each species apart, or like storm winds at sea. The borders between species are as fluid and adaptable, as sensitive to changes in pressure, as the heaving waves in a high sea. And winds can split the waves, as if splitting the mountains or sending a new mountain or new archipelago up above the rest. What drives the first widening wedge? It is, to switch metaphors, a little like the splitting of an amoeba. One population goes one way and one goes the other. You have one vessel, one gene pool, and you end up with two. And the beginning of the split can be a very small thing. A detail can make the difference. Even a detail that has no adaptive significance can make all the difference in the world. In other words, the origin of species can lie in the kinds of small, subjective decisions and revisions that in our species come under the heading of romance. We are exquisitely sensitive to one another's features, and they can be more fateful than we dream. Cleopatra's nose, had it been shorter, the whole face of the world would have been changed, says Blaise Pascal in his Pensée. A little less from bridge to tip, or a little more, and Julius Caesar and Mark Antony might not have fallen in love with her. If Cleopatra's nose had been shaped a little less like the Grecian ideal, and a little more like Cleopatra's needle, there would have been no Alexandrine War, no sea fight at Actium. The whole arc of the Roman Empire would have been reshaped by Cleopatra's beak. When Darwin met Captain Fitzroy for his job interview, the captain took an instant dislike to Darwin's nose. The captain was an amateur phrenologist and physiognomist, and prided himself on his ability to judge the character of his men by their skull bumps. Fitzroy felt sure that he was looking at the nose of a lazy man. He almost sent Darwin home. We might have lost the origin and the descent of man. The whole face of human thought was almost changed by Darwin's beak. On the island of Genovesa, sheltered by Darwin Bay, there is a lagoon that is one of the loveliest and even sexiest spots in the Galapagos. It is a pale blue pool of clear water and white coral sand, with no leeches and no sharks. Masked boobies gather in the bushes that fringe the lagoon and perch on the lava bluffs above it, among the prickly pear trees. Great frigate birds with deflated red balloons, gular sacs, dangling from their chests fly overhead. In courting season, these males stand around together among the salt bushes. Each time a female flies by, they shake their wings, puff out their shockingly red balloons, throw back their heads, and howl. The Grant family camped by this lagoon for years. Nicola and Thalia may be the only human beings ever to have been more or less raised in this strange paradise, beneath the phantasmagoria of booby cries and finch songs and the big wing rustles of circling frigate birds. Here they read The Swiss Family Robinson and hated it. They thought it was ridiculous that everything the family needed simply washed ashore. They liked Robinson Crusoe better because that was more like life in the clamorous solitudes of Daphne and Genovesa. The girls built driftwood rafts and did their homework in the middle of the lagoon, homeschooling on Genovesa. Lorraine Ratcliffe remembers Nicky one year playing the violin to the lava gulls. And it was here at the lagoon that Thalia learned to draw. The Grants first began camping here in 1978, the year after the Great Drought. They pitched a tent on the cliff above the lagoon and began to measure variation in the beaks of the large cactus finches. As part of their standard measurements, they looked at the two groups of singers on the island, the A singers and the B singers. The A's were singing variations on a theme that sounded like cha-cha-cha. The B's were singing variations on a shorter theme that sounded like churr. That first year by the lagoon, the Grants were surprised to find that the A's and B's differed slightly in their beaks. The A's beaks were on average narrower, shallower, and longer than the B's. The difference in length was only about a millimeter, but of course, a millimeter can make a world of difference. In fact, that year, in the dry season, they saw the A's, with their longer beaks, drilling holes in cactus fruits and pulling out the seeds. They never saw any of the bees doing that. Instead, the bees were concentrating on fallen cactus pads, ripping and tearing them open with their beaks, eating the pulp and picking out the grubs. The Grants never saw any of the A's doing that. So when it came to feeding, the single millimeter's difference was forcing the two groups of singers somewhat apart. No one had been posted to watch the finches on this island the year before, during the drought. But the drought had struck here, as it had on Daphne Major. And although the Grants could not be sure, the stress of the drought might have caused this disruption in the large cactus finches, much as it had caused a split in Fortis, the medium ground finches, on Daphne. In that split, Fortis with the very biggest and very smallest beaks were favored. The biggest were favored because they could handle the big seeds that are the province of Magnerostris. A few of the very smallest female Fortis were favored because they were able to poach the smallest seeds, the niche of Fuliginosa. So the drought might have caused a split here too, although no one had been here to watch it happen. The Grants found another surprise. Among the mated males, there was not a single pair of neighbors singing the same song. Yet among the bachelors, the unmated males, the territories were a mix, sometimes A next to A, sometimes A next to B. This suggested to the Grants that the females were choosing to settle down only with males whose neighbors sang the other song type. When the first rains come to the Galapagos, large females are ready to mate a few days earlier than small females. These large females, who get first choice of the males, tend to choose males whose neighbors, whose nearest rivals, are not singing their song. Now, there were more B's than A's, so the A's stood out and were most attractive to the big females. In this way, the year before, during the drought, more big females might have mated with the A singers, and their offspring might have had larger beaks than the B's. Then, in the intense drought, the differences in beak length could have been widened further by disruptive selection. Those with the longest beaks could drill the fruits best, and those with the shortest could rip the pads best. Selection would favor the longest and the shortest beaks and widen the difference between them. The Grants will never know for sure if that is what really happened. They still kick themselves, if only they had been at the lagoon the year before. An evolutionist has written, "It is a fundamental difficulty of an historical science, like the study of evolution, that one can never establish the cause of a past event." In this case, the past event was less than a year before. Whatever happened during the drought year, the Grants could see that the population had split slightly apart, as if by the thin edge of the wedge. The separation in breeding also showed up in a more direct way in the nest. When Darwin's finches first hatch, their beaks are always either pink or yellow. It is much the same with barnyard chickens. The beaks of a brood of hatchlings may be all pink, all yellow, or some of one and some of the other. The color lasts for their first 2 months of life. As the Grants went around banding nestlings that year, they noticed that the nests of the Song A males had more than twice as many yellow-beaked chicks as the nests of the Song Bs. If the two groups had been mating and mixing at random, that would not have happened. They would have fathered roughly equal frequencies of yellows and pinks. So it seemed the gene pools of the A's and the B's were partly divided too. Thus the Grants were looking at two groups that showed signs of developing the kinds of fixed differences in beaks, songs, and survival skills that mark the separate species of Darwin's finches. The difference in the beak measurements of the two groups, the A's and the B's, was about 6%. The difference in separate species of Darwin's ground finches averages about 15%. Subdivision is incipient speciation, the Grants write, and then add with their usual caution, or at least it provides the potential for speciation. At the time, they thought that might be what they were about to see. Unfortunately, the dry season of 1978 was very dry on Genovesa. Of the 120 nestlings the Grants banded by the lagoon, only six were still alive a year later. So the Grants could see that they would need to keep watch a long time on Genovesa, as on Daphne, to understand what might be going on. It would not have taken much for the split between the A's and the B's to widen. The daughters of these two lines would have to keep on choosing males that sang the same song as their fathers. Then the division would have kept on growing. But the next year, the females around the lagoon chose males that sang the opposite song as their fathers as often as they chose males who sang the same song as their fathers. They chose males with the long form of the beak as often as males with the short form. Maybe a difference of only a millimeter is not enough to make or break a couple. Because they interbred this way, the beaks of their sons and daughters were in between the beak lengths of the two lines, and the tantalizing differences in beak length disappeared and fell apart. Their offspring no longer ate in two different ways, and they were as likely to have yellow or pink beaks as anybody else. By 1979, the checkerboarding of the territories of the A's and B's was gone, although it may have appeared again briefly once or twice, just for a week at a time in later years. The Grants feel sure it did, but to a disinterested observer, their evidence seems softer than usual here. The boundaries of birds' territories are harder to measure than the shapes of their beaks. And of course, the Grants were looking very hard to see if that checkerboard would come back. In any case, by 1981, the link between the shape of the beak and the songs of the A's and the B's was completely gone. A millimeter still made the difference between the fruit borers and the pad rippers, but the birds no longer divided into A's and B's. In 1985, another drought came to Genovesa, and this time the Grants were there to watch. Not a single drop of rain fell that year. But this time, the drought did not partition the birds into two groups, as the Grants believe it may have done in 1977. Of course, the island was a different place in this drought than it was in the one before, because of the crazy Niño of 1982 through 1983. Most of the cactus trees had been overrun and toppled by vines. There were hardly any fruits and seeds to be had anywhere in anyone's territory. So the pressures of the drought favored short, deep beaks for ripping up dried cactus pads, but there was no separate niche for skinny, long beaks. The drought of 1985 pushed the whole population in the direction of the only niche that was open to them. The survivors had significantly deeper beaks. In a sense, the future evolution of this population of cactus finches is cramped by its neighbors. These cactus finches are not alone by the lagoon. There are sharp beaks to pick up the small seeds, and there are big beaks to pick up the really big seeds. So the cactus finches are hemmed in. There is no big new empty niche waiting for a group of them, like adventurous colonists, to split off and explore. At least, there is no niche the Grants can see. These finches have been on Genovesa for a long, long time. There is no new world out there by the lagoon that is just sitting there, ripe for the taking. Thus the Grants suspect that the finches here are perpetually being forced slightly apart and drifting back together again. A drought favors groups of one beak length or another. It splits the population and forces it onto two slightly separate adaptive peaks. But because the two peaks are so close together, and there is no room for them to widen farther apart, random mating brings the birds back together again. These two forces of fission and fusion fight forever among the birds. The force of fission works toward the creation of a whole new line, a lineage that could shoot off into a new species. The force of fusion brings them back together. What the Grants saw was the population cinching at the waist like an amoeba in the act of dividing, and the division was just a millimeter in the birds' beaks.